Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you're the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hello, friends. We are the Ladies of Strange. I'm Ashley.
I'm Tiffany.
And I'm Rebecca.
Have you ever wondered if Jenny's head really did fall off when they removed the green ribbon?
Or if aliens are hiding in the tails of comets waiting to take us away?
Or if there's any scientific basis to the Ouija board?
Well, then don't risk your search history and join us each Thursday as we discuss
the history, mystery, and theory
of all things questionable, odd, and eerie. New episodes are released every Thursday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. More information about the show, including show notes and links to our social media, can be found on our website, theladiesofstrange.com.
Keep it strange, lovelies.
The Evidence Locker is a weekly podcast about international true crime. Made by hardcore true crime fans, it's somewhat grungy. Join us as we explore the dark corners of the globe. We've covered cases from Sweden, Brazil, Australia, and the US, to mention a few. Find us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, Cam.
Hi, Jen. How are you?
I'm doing great.
What's going on?
Easter's coming up.
I know. Are you excited?
It's Easter. Yeah. Halloween's my favorite, as I know it's yours, too.
It is.
But, you know, the kids are excited.
For candy.
For candy. Of course, you know, they think I'm too old for that. But then they're like, are we going to have an Easter egg hunt?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, well, we were just thinking about, you know, instead of a basket of candy, maybe we'll take you shopping or something. No, we want the candy.
I just tell my kids that, hey, this year we're going to do something different. We're going to donate your candy to the needy, and you guys are going to go out and volunteer and help clean streets.
Yeah, did they cry?
The look was like, you're joking, right?
Yeah, well, gotta love kids.
Mm.
They're good.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you have big plans?
Nope, nothing. And I'm pretty excited. Off work.
Nice. Doing anything fun?
Probably writing more podcasts. Scripts.
We went to see Shazam last night.
How was it?
It was a kid's movie. Well, it was goofy.
Do you remember watching
Shazam? Oh, Shazam. I loved Shazam as a kid.
Yeah, me too.
And it was cute.
I mean, it was cute.
Yeah. Well, Shocker. We took the oldest daughter and she liked his little sidekick. She's like, I could so date him.
Who was the sidekick?
I don't know the kid's name in real life, but he was like this goofy, kind of smart alecky sidekick. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody totally that she liked.
Yes. What do you got for me today, Jen?
Well, I tell you, I got this story that I started because I had seen it on a TV show a while ago, and I had never really looked into it. I always kind of knew it, but not really. Mm-hmm. Got so deep. My script is about 16 pages long.
Oh.
Seriously. It just got
deep.
I know you do. Deep and hard. And this one, I was floored how...
The killers are crazy. The people, the suspects, whatever you want to call them.
The whole thing was just kind of nuts.
Oh.
Actually, it's labeled as one of the most bizarre crimes.
Ooh,
goody. And it takes place in 1968 down in Hotlanta, Georgia.
Hotlanta.
The center of our story is a Barbara Jane Mackle. Now, she was a young woman, and she lived the life that many other girls would dream of. She was very smart. She was in her third year at Emory University in Decatur, Georgia, and she was studying economics. She was a member of the Delta sorority.
Delta. Can I help you?
Mm-hmm. She was a tri delt. She was dating a wonderful boy by the name of Stuart Woodward. And her father just happened to be a Miami real estate tycoon worth millions. Mm. Now, her father, Robert Mackle, and his brothers owned one of the largest real estate development companies in the United States. They developed Marco Island, down in Florida, Port Lucie, and Deltona, which is actually the largest city in the Volusia County, Florida. But even though they were very wealthy, one of Barbara's friends said, you would never have guessed it, that they were the quiet kind of rich. And they were very down to earth. Well, quietly rich was living in a 5,300 square foot house. Then okay.
Quietly rich, yeah.
And another family friend, and trust me, I would track this person down. She said Barbara was really popular and an excellent student, that they wouldn't exactly call her pretty, but she was attractive.
Oh my.
And then another one, trust me, that would not give her name. This one said, well, people are saying that her and Stuart are engaged and he's her fiance, but I've seen her with numerous other men. Caddy, meow, right?
If the news ever comes to talk to you about me, will you say positive things, please?
Of course I will. I will lie. In December, during finals, Barbara came down with the flu. Mm. Not just wasn't any flu.
It was a bottle flu.
It was the Hong Kong flu, which got me singing Hong Kong flu-y.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. So that's what. Now, the Hong Kong flu was pretty serious. It started actually in July in China in 1968, and it lasted until 1970s. Oh. And the outbreak was the third influenza pandemic that actually happened. Yikes. In the 20th century. And first being the Spanish flu. The virus was very contagious, and within 2 weeks of its emergence in July in Hong Kong, 500,000 cases of illness had been reported, and then the virus proceeded to spread swiftly throughout Southeast Asia.
Wow.
Within several months, it had reached the Panama Canal Zone and the United States, where it had been taken from overseas by soldiers returning to California from Vietnam. Mm-hmm. By the end of December, the virus had spread throughout the United States and had reached the United Kingdom and countries in Western Europe, Australia, Japan, and multiple countries in Africa. Eastern Europe, Central and South America were also affected.
That was Jen from the CDC with your annual report on the flu.
Of Wiki. So, but it occurred in two waves, and the second wave actually caused more deaths than the first wave.
I just realized something. Barbara has the flu, and Janine had the flu.
Huh.
Huh.
The Hong Kong flu resulted in an estimated 1 to 4 million deaths, whereas the Spanish flu caused about 25 to 50 million deaths. So this was no light case. The flu had actually hit the university campus pretty hard, and the college infirmary was full. So Barbara's mother, Jane, drove from their home in Cape Coral, Florida, and came down to care for her. Jane took Barbara off of campus and put her into a $32 a night room at the Roadway Inn Motel, which was close to the campus.
I like that you included the price there.
It was. It was actually room 137. On December 17th, even though Barbara was still sick, her boyfriend Stuart Woodward came and visited. They stayed up most of the night and they talked, and he left. And he said when he left, he kind of had the feeling that somebody was watching him, but he never really thought anything of it. And so the mother and daughter got ready for bed. Barbara put on her red checked nightgown, and she just wasn't able to sleep. She wasn't feeling the best, but she just wasn't able to sleep. Around 4 a.m., someone started pounding on the Mackle's motel room door, saying that there had been a car accident with a white Ford. Stuart Woodward drove a white Ford, and they said that the person was in the hospital, and he wanted those two to come to the hospital with them.
Don't go.
So Mrs. Mackle had no reason to doubt what they were being told, because who else knew that Stuart had a white car, he would be on the road. So even though Barbara said don't open it, Jane opened the door, and she saw a man in the police hat. And all of a sudden, the man rushed at Jane. He tackled her to the ground. And inside came a smaller man that was dressed all in black with a ski mask. and he had a gun. I mean, Jane thought it was a boy. He was just tiny. And they had a rifle, a high-powered rifle, and they were pointing it at Jane and Barbara. Now, Barbara at the time just thought they were being robbed, right? And so she just kept on saying, take any money you want, just take it and get out. And the guy never said anything, but he took a rag that had been soaked in chloroform and covered Jane's nose and mouth over it, and she lost consciousness. Now, different stories. Some say she lost consciousness. Others said she didn't lose consciousness. I don't know, but we're going to go with she lost consciousness. Jane was then tied up with Venetian blind cords that were in one of the people's pockets, and they put duct tape over her mouth. The smaller of the intruders tried to put the chloroform cloth over Barbara's mouth, but she's like, no, no, I'll be good. I promise I'll be good. So then both the bigger guy grabbed Barbara and carried her out the door. So at about 5:30, about an hour and a half later, the night motel clerk kept hearing this car blaring in the parking lot of the hotel. So he went out and started screaming at the offender saying, you're going to wake everybody up. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Well, sitting in the green Pontiac Firebird was a woman who was hitting her head on the car horn. And when she heard the clerk yell at her, she looked up and the clerk noticed that this woman had been bound and gagged. Oh. It was Jane Mackle.
Oh, the mom.
She had woken up and made her way out to the parking lot, still bound, and was able to get in her daughter's car and make noise. She tried to use the phone, but the phone was disconnected. But after the clerk took off the tape of the woman's mouth, she's like, I've been robbed. They've taken my daughter. At first, when the Georgia police were called, they thought it was like some drunken prank, that it was a college prank, that maybe Stewart was involved with it. So they weren't really getting involved too much. But they were kind of taking it seriously. They put roadblocks set up. All the patrol cars were under alert, but they didn't take it too terribly seriously. So about this time, back at the Mackle house, Robert Mackle was awakened by telephone. Still kind of groggy from his sleep, he answers the phone, and he's trying to make out what the other person's saying. He kind of hears, they tried to chloroform Jane and they took Barbara. And all of a sudden, it finally hits him that his daughter's been kidnapped. So he gets on his private plane, and he flies to Georgia. Mr. Mackle is not exactly one to mess with. He's got very powerful friends. And one of those friends was the president-elect at the time.
Oh.
Richard Nixon.
I hope these
tricky dick
abductors know that.
So by the time Mr. Mackle was informed of Barbara's kidnapping, over 150 FBI agents were sent to start working on this case.
Probably not the smartest guys there to do that then.
After the intruders took Barbara, they put her in a car and they drove about 20 miles until they reached this remote area with heavy pine trees in this forest. They forced Barbara out of the car and said, well, I guess you know why you're here. We're kidnapping you, and you're worth quite a bit of money, and we're asking for quite a bit of money. So they pulled up her nightgown and gave her a shot, which was a harmless sedative, and then they just briefly put chloroform over her face just to make her woozy. So then they hand her a sign with the word kidnapped, and it's badly written, right? And then they take her picture. Well, she looked funny. She looked like she was miserable.
Drugged.
Oh, I wonder why. She's sick. She's just been kidnapped, and she's drugged. And she just looked grim. So he told her to smile. Boy, God, don't you love it when people tell you to smile?
I'll tell you.
So the first picture he didn't like because she didn't smile. Second picture, she smiled. He said that they wanted her to look happy because they wanted her family to know she's alive, and the smile would prove that she's alive. So then one of the kidnappers took the opal ring off Barbara's finger and placed it in his pocket. Now, she wore an opal ring because that is her birthstone.
Oh, just like us.
I know. Her birthday's October 19th.
Oh.
I know, right in between ours. So then they picked Barbara up and placed her in a hole that already had fiberglass reinforced plywood box inside.
Like a coffin. It's terrible.
She started screaming, don't do this to me. Don't do this to me. Let me go. And he's like, oh, come on. Don't be a baby.
How about you get in here with me, buddy?
Yeah. The kidnappers then proceeded to screw the lid on and then cover it up with the red Georgia clay. She was buried 2 feet underground.
I'm not claustrophobic, but I could not.
I couldn't do it. Now, there were 2 ventilating pipes in this coffin-like box. It was a coffin. I mean, it was the same shape.
They put work in this.
Yes, they did. They got
a ventilation system in there, right?
Mm-hmm. So once everything was closed and the ground was covered, they covered it up with the dirt. The kidnappers started speaking into the tubes.
To her,
because there's tubes that came out of the ground, mm-hmm. the ventilation tubes. And they said not to worry. She had food and water, and there's a blanket, and there was a light with a small fan that was operated by batteries. Now, there was also a pump that would get rid of the water because, you know, she's underground and the water would seep in. Should it rain really hard? Because they knew that the coffin would leak if it rained really hard. So they put a pump so she wouldn't drown.
Oh, my. That is terrible.
There was also a bedpan in there.
Could she even move around, or was she like placed on it?
Cramped. It was like 8 by 3.5 by 2 or something like that. It wasn't big. They also told her that the batteries that ran the fan and the light should be good for 7 days if she used it sparingly. But if she wasted it,
hitting the ground, you've got to be kidding me.
But if she wasted it, it would only be about 2.5 days maybe. And they also left her a box of sanitary napkins.
Just in case. You know.
Because you're going to worry about that mm-hmm. when you're 2 feet underground in a box where nobody knows where you are.
I'd be worrying about drowning.
Pitch black.
Oh, that's terrible.
And in the box.
Did they give her a book or anything?
Well, they left a note in the sanitary napkin box that said that whether her dad paid the ransom or not, that they'd be back in a week and they'd let her go.
That's so nice of
them. 7 days.
That's so nice of them.
By 9:10 that morning, Mr. Mackle was in Georgia, and before he left, he actually had one of his brothers or the family friend come over to his house and said, just in case somebody tries to make contact, I want somebody here. So he had a friend come to the house while he went to Georgia, and which was smart because at 9:10, there's a phone call that was made to the Mackle's house, which was an unlisted phone number. So how these kidnappers got the number, I don't know.
They don't seem real smart.
The caller instructed them to search the lot or the yard of the Mackle's home. Mm-hmm. And in the corner under this certain palm tree, they would find something. They went out to search, and under a rock in a bottle was a 3-page ransom note. So Mr. Mackle was called. And he and his wife flew back immediately to wait for the kidnappers' phone calls. The ransom note stated that Barbara was buried in a box and would be allowed to suffocate if a ransom of $500,000 was not paid. So the money was to consist of used $20 bills that were circulated. They weren't to be in serial numerical order. They were to be bound up in $1,000 packets. And if Mr. Mackle accepted the terms, he was to place a classified ad in the Miami Herald under the personal section. It was supposed to read, "Loved one, please come home. We will pay all expenses and meet you anywhere at any time. Your family."
I'd do a classified saying, F off.
No, you wouldn't.
No, I wouldn't. But in my head, I would.
I know. So the ad, of course, was placed, and the ad was roughly about $3 to place. So they had to spend $500,003 on her.
So far.
That's
not
just
to mention the therapy she's going to need.
So if she survives. So as soon as Mr. Mackle heard that his daughter had been buried alive, he was claustrophobic to begin with, but he's like, you know what? If she survived this, she would never be the same. Mm-mm. Like, who would be able to keep their sanity after mm-hmm. something like this? Mm-hmm. And then he was thinking, you know, who would be so inhuman to bury somebody alive? How could you do that to somebody?
That is terrible. I cannot, like, that would have to be one of the worst ways to go because you're just sitting there waiting to die or
to
be
suffocate.
Rescued.
Yeah. No, it'd be horrible. Mm-mm-mm. Back then, $500,000 was $3.7 million now. I mean, it's a lot of money, And Mr. Mackle instructed his bank to hurry up and get the ransom money together. And they didn't have a problem doing it. They worked day and night to do it. But the biggest problem that they had was trying to find a suitcase that was big enough for the money to fit in.
That's quite a bit of money.
Finally, the wife of the bank's vice president found a suitcase big enough to be in her closet to use. On December 18th, the mailman delivers an envelope to the Mackle residence, in which the FBI quickly intercepts. And inside is Barbara's opal ring and the Polaroid of Barbara holding the kidnap sign.
Not
the one
smiling.
Where she was smiling. No, she was smiling in this
okay.
one. On December 19th at 3:45 a.m., Mr. Mackle received a telephone call at his home from the kidnappers, telling Mackle to leave immediately and drive to the foot of Fair Isle Drive at Biscayne Bay. There was a road and a bridge that was blocked off every evening at 8 o'clock, and he was told to leave the ransom money on a sandy strip near the bridge and then leave. Now, this is a really affluent area. Mm-hmm. Like, nowadays, I think one of the cheapest houses I found was $600,000. On that sandy strip, there would be a box that had a blinking light, and he was supposed to put the suitcase in that blinking light box. So Mr. Mackle left immediately, took the suitcase containing the ransom money, and when he got there, he wasn't able to find the box or a light. He couldn't find it at all.
A blinking light is not obvious. Nobody would investigate that.
No, at all. Mm-hmm. At 4:41 a.m., the kidnappers telephoned the Mackle home again, complaining, and Mr. Mackle's brother Frank answered the phone. And the kidnappers complained that the money was not there and it wasn't where it was instructed. And Frank assured them that Mr. Mackle had left and he was going to the specified spot. Finally, Mr. Mackle just left the money and returned home.
So and he then just put it down?
Well, he put it on the sandbar. So when he came back, they said he was in tears because he thought he messed the whole thing up and he basically killed his daughter. Mm-hmm. Here's fun. So soon after Mr. Mackle left the suitcase, a neighbor in the subdivision or in the area that they were at heard a motorboat that was coming down in one of the shallow canals that was on Fair Isle, which was actually now called Grove Isle. And it was in between the mainland and the Grove Isle. The houses in the neighborhood had been getting robbed. The robbers had been coming in by boat. Mm. So he heard the motorboat and he called the police. The FBI and the Miami police were not in communication. Two officers were sent to investigate, and they had no idea that there was a ransom drop going on at the time. Around 5 a.m., the Miami police saw two people coming out of the wooded area near the bridge, and they started heading towards this Volvo station wagon. They had a whole bunch of gear with them. The police, thinking that these were the robbers, ordered them to stop. But instead, the two dropped what they had and took off running.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it's FBI. Okay. Mm-mm.
Nope.
Oh, okay.
So the police started to chase them, but they didn't catch them. So they go back and they find a suitcase. They find scuba gear. And inside the suitcase, they find more money than they've ever seen before in their life.
Them, huh?
Mm-hmm. The police, of course, just assumed that these were the robbers and the money belonged to somebody in one of the houses. So they took it back to the police station, and then FBI was contacted, and they said, yeah, that's the ransom money, and it was the whole botched situation, and Mr. Mackle was like, she's dead. My daughter's dead.
How did police and the FBI not be in communication with something that big?
It doesn't sound like they were.
No.
He's like, my God, Mr. Mackle's like, my God, they're going to kill my daughter, and I don't really care about the money. I just want my daughter back. Police went back to the scene. And they found an abandoned white boat and a blue Volvo station wagon. They ran the boat's registration number, and it indicated that the boat belonged to the University of Miami Institute of Marine Sciences. In the Volvo, the police found a passport for a Ruth Eisman Shear, two one-way airline tickets to Vegas, and six Polaroid snapshots.
So their getaway plan is to go to Vegas, all places.
Well, who doesn't like to go
no
to Vegas?
No one will find us.
They're
going to
double that money. We're going to double that money. Some of those Polaroid snapshots were of a man and some were of a woman.
Oh.
They were scantily dressed and nude. They were sexy shots. Very sexy. One photo was the grim-looking Barbara Mackle.
The non-smiling
one. Mm-hmm. So they traced the license plate of the Volvo to George Deacon. And he worked for where?
Her dad.
The Marine Institute.
Oh.
They lifted dozens of fingerprints from the automobile. And fingerprints came back as Gary Crist.
These people have to be totally stupid.
And he was a fugitive felon. The university, they took the pictures and everything to the university, and they identified the woman in the Polaroid prints.
The sexy ones?
Mm-hmm. As a biologist at the Marine Institute.
Ooh, she's doing her own biology.
And that was Ruth Eisman Shear. So the police started to look for them. After this botched drop-off, thanks to the Miami police, well, it really wasn't their fault. It was just like a series of unfortunate events.
No, I'm just laughing about the couple. Okay,
yeah,
go ahead.
Okay, so Mr. Mackle begged the FBI. He's like, you know what? We've got to do something to let the kidnappers know not to kill my daughter. We're trying whatever we can, you know, to get them the money. I just want my daughter alive. They decided to do a press release in the newspaper. And the statement said, I had nothing. This is Mr. Mackle talking. I had nothing to do with the action Thursday morning of the Miami police who tried to arrest you and recovered the money which I had left for you. I regret that you did not get the money because my only interest is the safety of my daughter. I pray that you have not harmed my daughter. I did everything you told me to do. I had nothing to do with the accidental appearance of the Miami police on the scene. Please contact me again through my any channel. I will do anything you asked so my daughter will be freed.
It is interesting to note here at this point, back then they didn't have the internet. They didn't have 24-hour news cycles. I'm sure you were a panic. How do I get it? You're going to have to wait till the newspaper comes out.
Or the news, but the news only came on at 5 and 10.
It's terrible.
Yeah. The statement was featured in all the afternoon newspapers, and by 10 p.m. that evening, Mr. Mackle received a telephone call from the kidnappers.
I'm dumb and dumber.
And the instructions were simple, and it said, now go to the end of the dirt road off Tam Miami Trail, 9 miles west of Miami. Leave the suitcase of money. If there is no interference, you will receive another call before noon Friday telling you where to find your daughter. Mr. Mackle did what he was told, and the FBI checked the scene at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they found that the money had been picked up. And then they waited at their mansion for a call. Nobody called.
Did they get the money?
They were devastated. The kidnappers got the money, yeah. So at 3 p.m., a switchboard operator at the Atlanta office of the FBI received a call from a man that said, listen carefully. I will only give this once so you can't trace me. And they gave directions within a tenth of a mile to Barbara's location.
Oh.
8 cars of FBI agents raced to the spot. It was an abandoned home site overgrown with thorny bushes, high weeds, just tons of...
The weeds were on drugs?
Mm-hmm. However, there was no sign of a grave. Nothing. They knew she was buried. Couldn't find it. The agents were out there for hours, and they were about to give up when one man heard a faint knock. Yeah. He fell on his hands and knees and started crawling around into the bushes. In the bushes, he found a freshly turned earth with 2 protruding tubes. The agent said, Barbara, is that you? This is the FBI. Can you hear me? Knock again. And the knocking sound was repeated.
Oh, she's alive.
She's alive. The agent then said, hey, she's here. And so all the agents began clawing into the earth with their bare hands and sticks, because even though they knew she was buried, nobody bought a shovel. Seriously.
I guess they didn't have, like, a kit that they had in their car.
I don't know, but you would think.
Box and skull.
We're going to go find a kidnapped victim that's been buried underground, but nobody thinks to get a shovel. It only took 12 minutes and a lot of bleeding hands to get to the coffin lid. All the while, they're just like, hang on, Barbara, we got you, we got you. We'll get you out, we'll get you out. They had a tire iron, which they used to pry the lid of the coffin off. And inside was Barbara, still in her red-checked pajamas, soaking wet.
Oh, God, that'd be so
crying from the shock, from the relief of being found, that she just
overwhelmed.
Was overwhelmed. Yeah. First thing she said, how are my parents?
Oh, that was nice.
So nice. The agents cried as they lifted her out of the box, and she was unable to stand, so they carried her to the cars and radioed the dispatch.
So how long was she in the ground from?
83 hours.
Oh, my God. It's terrible.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. So they radioed the dispatcher, and they said that Barbara had been found. They had her with her.
You know, it's also like, if they would have went through all that, and it was a thorny, overgrown area, like you said,
mm-hmm.
the bad guys never made... Like, she could have just died there if that one guy wouldn't have heard her. You know what mm-hmm. I mean?
He gave him directions to, like, 1/10 of a mile to where she was.
Mm-hmm. Still, though.
After she was found, the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, my dad's ex-boss, personally called the Mackles to let them know that Barbara was alive. Mm-hmm. And she was in good shape considering what she had been through the past 3 nights and 4 days. The Miami police knew that they were on the lookout for Crist and for Ruth Eisman Scheer. They were both put on the FBI Most Wanted list. The big thing about this FBI Most Wanted list, Ruth was the first woman ever to be put in the top 10.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good little tidbit.
They found out that Crist had rented a car in West Palm Beach at a parking lot near the waterfront under the name Arthur Horowitz, and he paid with it in $20 bills. Among $400 worth of additional equipment he bought was a chart for the intercoastal waterway through Lake Okeechobee to the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So 15 minutes after the purchase, the man who called himself Horowitz sped up the intercoastal way towards St. Lucie and turned into the Okeechobee Canal. The police learned that he had passed through the Okeechobee locks about an hour earlier. The Coast Guard at St. Petersburg was sent to patrol the Gulf Coast. They had choppers on him, and they spotted the suspect off Cayo Costa. The helicopter dropped really low to look at the driver of this boat, and they positively identified the driver as being Gary Stephen Kirst.
That's weird. Right? I mean, to think that they could, I guess they had binoculars.
Part of the story that I read was told by Milton Butch Buffington.
Is he married to Bibbs and Babs over there by Chip?
I don't know, but at the time in 1968, he was the popular meat department manager at the USAID. He was also a special deputy for the Charlotte County Sheriff, Jack Bent. Milton owned 2 Bloodhound track dogs and 2 German Shepherd attack dogs. He was usually called on to aid searches for fleeing criminals. So he was called. So he talks about how Crist headed, let me read this real quick. The fleeing boat suddenly swerved through Boca Grande Pass in an apparent effort to elude the chase craft, but the copter never lost contact. Ahead was a desolate wooded shore. Crist headed for it and rammed his boat into a sandy strip surrounded by dense mangroves. He leaped from the boat with a small suitcase and struggled into the mud and mangroves. The time was 1:30 p.m. The place was Hog Island, just below El Jobing. Sheriff deputies, state police, and FBI agents, in all, 200 armed men, swooped to the area by car, boat, and air sleds. The airboats.
Mm-hmm.
The good guys tied yellow ribbons around our hats to identify ourselves. I still have mine. This happened about 50 years ago, and this interview was not too long ago. They found in the abandoned boat, the registration number had matched the boat that was sold to the Arthur Horowitz, and they found a duffel bag with $480,000 in $20 bills. So he was ordered to join in the hunt. Milton went home to get his dogs to track.
I love that he's a butcher by day and secret agent man by night.
I know. So about an hour later, Milton came back with his dogs. And he found that the FBI agents that were chasing, that were in pursuit of Crist, they were in three-piece suits, and their city shoes were floundering in the mud.
Those boys, those city slickers need to learn how to...
Many of the FBI agents stepped in that mud, and you know how the mud sucks your shoes off? Yeah. So he said, obviously, none of them had ever been tangled up in a mangrove grove before. They went over to Hog Island, and they really couldn't do much because dogs can't hold the scent when everything's wet. Milton Butch Buffington says it can't. So Milton took his dogs home, came back after changing into dry clothes. It was about 10 o'clock at night, and the search party had pretty much gathered around a campfire to wait for daylight because there was no use to look for the fugitive at night. So around midnight, they heard soft splashing in the water.
Not hard splashing.
No, soft.
Okay.
It sounded like someone walking along the edge of the water. Milton and his buddy quietly walk into the water, trying not to make a sound. And the splashing kind of stopped, and then it started again. And then he heard a rustle in the bushes, and then they shined a flashlight, and there he was.
The merman?
Crist was sitting on a log with a small suitcase, and they said, "Put your hands up. You're under arrest." Crist raised his hand. And they went up to him with their guns out, ready to go, and he didn't move. And he just said, "I'm tired. Can I have a drink?"
I hear you, buddy. I hear you.
Mm-hmm. So they put cuffs on him, and then they fired three shots in the air to call for help. They took him back to camp, and when they dragged him ashore, he collapsed on the ground. He was so exhausted. And in the suitcase that he had, the duffel bag, they found $18,000 of the ransom money. That was the last of the $500,000 that he had hoped to get away with. Then, of course, the FBI agents came and took Crist and put them into one of the cars and took them to Fort Myers, back to their station, their
precinct,
fort, their lair. I don't know, whatever it's called. But, of course, once they did, they forgot to take the suitcase of money, which was the evidence. Milton was carrying it. So the FBI took Crist, but they left the evidence. The next day, the FBI came back to get the evidence.
These things, like, new on the job? Or what?
I don't know. It makes me laugh, though. There was only one casualty of this search, and it occurred when two state wildlife officers are rushing in their car to get to an airboat, slammed into another car on Tamiami Trail. The officers suffered broken bones, but Harry Taylor, a 63-year-old car salesman, was killed.
Aww.
Barbara was sent to the hospital to be checked out. She was fine. She was mentally stable, in good spirits.
Did she have food in there? I forgot.
She did have food, and she only ate, remembers eating candy and an apple. They also gave her water, but the water had sedatives in it. So 3 gallons of water. So every time she would drink, it would sedate her, which would actually kind of be helpful.
That's what I think. But except if you were sleeping when they came to find you and she didn't make noise. And
right.
Miss her.
The only thing that was different about hers was she was down 10 pounds.
The coffin diet.
The coffin diet. So everything was fine. She was back home. While she was home, they had a visit from the president-elect, Richard Nixon.
Oh.
And he suggested to her that she write a book, which she did with the help of a reporter from the Miami Herald, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, actually, by the name of Jean Miller. And it was the only time she ever wanted to talk about her ordeal. And she wrote the book. It's called 83 Hours. She said, "I'm writing this book because I never want to talk about it again. Everything you need to know is in this book." With the help of Jean Miller, she does write this book. But during her time in this coffin, she writes first person. I mean, it's her experience. She said that when she was first placed in the box, she was screaming and pounding on the lid. And she could hear the dirt.
Yeah.
As it was being shoveled on top.
That would be terrible.
And then it got quiet. And that's when she started to notice her surroundings. And she said it was dimly lit and there was water dripping, seeping in from the dirt. It was dripping down on her body and on her face, which would drive me nuts. She notices a note. And after loosening the ropes that they had tied around her wrist, she reads it. and the note begins, "Don't be alarmed. You are safe. You are presently inside a fiberglass-reinforced plywood box." And she said she laughed at the ridiculousness of the thing saying that you're safe. Mm-hmm. She said in no time, her nightgown and the blanket that was in there with her, she was soaking wet and she was cold. And she said she kept trying to talk to herself, telling her things to help her not to make the situation as bad as it really was. And she kept thinking to herself about how nice and cozy it was there, even though it wasn't. And how if she was outside, it would be cold. Or if she were out, maybe something could go wrong and the kidnappers would shoot her. But they can't get her here. She's safe here. I'm glad I'm here. She said, "I talked to myself this way, but it didn't work for long. I was cold and I was wet and I ached. I couldn't stretch out. Once I scrunched up and got stuck. I got real panicky thinking I was going to die this way." She said she would turn off the ventilating fan from time to time just to stop the noise because it would bother her. And then what would she do? She would sing songs. She said anything that was happy, any happy song. She sang everything from nursery rhymes, Christmas carols. She felt silly singing, but it made her feel good because she had such a bad voice that it would just...
The acoustics in there probably made it sound pretty good.
Mm-hmm. And she just said that it would just... She always made it her laugh. Then she thought about decorating her Christmas tree. And then pretty soon, the tiny light burned out.
That's what would scare me, because with all of that, you know the time is coming to an end there.
She said she was then in total darkness, couldn't see anything in front of her face. And she thought about being blind. And when she was a child, she used to pretend she was blind, and it was pretty scary. And she used to work for the blind. And I wondered what it would be like to be blind. And now I know. You want to see and you're frustrated. You can't see your hand in front of your face. And I thought, well, if people can spend their whole life like this, I can tolerate it.
She had a good attitude, really.
Well, yeah. Then she said her mind would wander and she'd think about walking on the campus with Stuart and ice skating. And she would remember him falling down and laughing. And one time it was cold and they were just running. They played leapfrog. She goes, it was just childish things. I thought of all the happy and fun things I could. And then I started to talk to God. She said, for a while, I was kind of agnostic, but when I was down there in the ground, I thought maybe I should believe more, and I just started talking as if God was beside me. I said, God, I know you're not going to let me die here. Even though nobody knows where I am, you know where I am. And she said that she found it very comforting. So after the book, she pretty much went silent. She took a semester off school after the ordeal, only a semester, and she went back and she graduated. In April of 71, she married Stuart Aww. Woodward. They have kids. I think she's a grandma now. They live in Atlanta. She's still alive. Aww. She's only 70-something. And she refuses to talk about the events. And she said that if you need anything, it's right there in the book. I'm done with it. Hmm. Unreal.
No, the case is crazy.
And she said the minute she thought about how her dad... He was told that she was in buried underground. She's like, I knew he would totally get upset because he's so claustrophobic wow. that he, yeah. And she's right.
What happened to the?
Oh, I'm coming.
Oh.
So.
I'm coming, Elizabeth.
I said that Gary Kirst and Ruth Eisman Scheer, both on the top 10 most wanted list. Mm-hmm. Well, Gary Kirst was arrested. Ruth Eisman Scheer was not to be found. They were still looking for her. And they were going to charge Kirst with mm-hmm. kidnapping, which is a death penalty case mm-hmm. ever since the little Lindbergh baby case. Mm-hmm. It's a death penalty. It's only death penalty if you ask for a ransom. The FBI thought, since Barbara wasn't taken across state lines, that they'd let prosecution in Georgia handle the case. But they were still holding out on interstate extortion, just in case the kidnapping didn't work out. So right before Kirst was about to go to trial, it's like 80 days after all this happened, mm-hmm. Ruth was arrested in Norman, Oklahoma. She was working as a car hop and going by the alias of Donna Yeals. The FBI was able to trace her to Oklahoma because she applied for a nursing position at Norman, Oklahoma.
She just thinks her life's going to go right back to normal.
And they did fingerprints, and fingerprints were ran.
Wow.
And back then, fingerprints was not on computer. There was no computer. My dad did fingerprints, and it was
by hand, literally
by hand. He told me about it. He had index cards, and they were labeled by swirls and ridges and that kind of stuff. Yeah, it was a long process. So let's talk about the kidnappers. Well, remember the station wagon plates that was traced back to a George Deacon? Mm-hmm. Well, that was an alias of Gary Kirst. Mm-hmm. He lived by the name George Deacon, and he worked at the Institute of Miami Sciences, and he was a marine researcher. And his IQ was near genius. It was about 140.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Gary Kirst was born in April of 45 in Alaska to a fishing family. His dad owned a fishing boat. He and his parents would go out during salmon and shrimp seasons, and it consumed most of their life. So Gary and his older brother, Gordon, spent a lot of time in the care of family friends. His parents weren't around a lot. By age of 9, he had a reputation as being a theft, petty theft. He stole coins, tools, penny candy, whatever. Didn't need it, just stole it anyway. By the age of 14, he was caught stealing a car. They sent him to be under federal supervision in a juvenile facility in Ogden, Utah. After nearly a year there, including a brief escape and a car theft, he was allowed to return to Alaska and attend high school in his hometown.
They didn't want him.
So Kirst did very well, and he was recognized as a very quick study, very bright kid. And after graduating high school, he went back to Ogden, Utah. And he wanted to pursue a medical degree. Well, college wasn't for him. And in August of 63, a few weeks before college classes started, he stole an El Camino and fled to Oakland, California. He abandoned his pregnant girlfriend in Ogden. So after a few days in California, he wrecked a stolen MG in Ventura, and he was sent to a state juvenile jail. And during his 14 months there, that's where he came up with an idea of kidnapping.
Yeah, all the juvie hall does is make you a better thief.
He felt most kidnappings fail because of poor planning and execution. He also decided that a young woman would be better than a child because children are kind of a hassle. And if he would choose a young male, they would be too much of a physical challenge. This is where he came up with the idea of burying his victims. He had everything planned out, from getaway vehicles to how to write the ransom note, all sorts of stuff. Since he had it all planned out, he just had to wait for the right time. So December of 64, he made his way to where his brother was studying in Palo Alto. In March of 65, he married a woman named Carmen Simon. They met at a roller rink in Redwood City. Within a few weeks, he was back in jail for what?
Stealing a car.
Car theft. Sentenced to 4 months. He couldn't help himself.
He's not very good at that car stealing.
No, but he can't help himself. His first wedding anniversary?
He was in the pen for car theft.
Back in prison, car theft. Yep. This time for 5 years.
Oh.
His son was born while he was in prison. But within 8 months, Gary and his cellmate escaped by scaling a fence. But only Gary was able to leave. His cellmate was shot. I don't know if he died or anything. Yeah. So then Gary fled with his wife and infant son to Boston, where he grew a beard.
Oh, they'll never catch him then.
And assumed the new identity of George Deacon. He landed a job as a research assistant at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which paid $7,500 a year. They lived in a trailer park in Norton, Massachusetts, right outside Boston, and they had their second son, Adam. They said he was really great at his job. He picked things up really, really quickly, but he could be obnoxious and he would crow about his high IQ and he would tell all these huge tales about all these alleged accomplishments that he did. Conflicts arose that made Kirst nervous about being discovered as being Kirst and not George Deacon. So he moved on the summer of 1968 to Miami University for the Marine Institute, still under the name of George Deacon, and they rented a mobile home on the trailer court on Northwest 14th Avenue in Miami. His salary then went to $8,500 a year. Here's where he meets Ruth. In September of 68, he was a boat hand on a two-week research trip to Bermuda. And that's where they began their affair. It was. He started to have an affair with Ruth Eisman, who was about 4 years older than her. She was very bright and very pretty, very petite. She was 5'2", I think. Mm-hmm. The newspaper, of course, always gives stats. She was 5'2", 110 pounds with green eyes. She was a very pretty grad student, and she was from Honduras. Her parents were Australian Jews who fled Central America to avoid Nazi persecution. Now, Christ was 6 foot and towered over Eisman, but Eisman could keep him in line. So the one thing Christ really liked about Eisman?
She was short.
Sex. Wow. After his wife had had two babies, Carmen was just not in the mood.
Thing.
So Eisman was willing to do anything, including taking risque Polaroids. In the newspapers.com, there is a 3-page confession of Ruth Eisman Scheer that was really interesting to read. So 3 weeks before Christmas, Gary Kirst told Carmen, his wife, that he no longer loved her, and he packed her up and sent her back to, and the kids, mm-hmm. to Redwood City.
Sex wins out all the time.
Always. Carmen later told reporters that she didn't bear a grudge against Kirst, that she wasn't surprised about his mistress because he often lobbied his wife to allow him to lead a sexually open lifestyle, but she just wasn't into it.
That was pretty risque for back then.
And she's like, you know, Gary doesn't want to lead a mediocre life. He wants to be rich. He wants to be remembered. Eisman, of course, enthusiastically took the place of Carmen's wife in the trailer. So at the very beginning of their relationship, Kirst told Eisman that he had dreams of being wealthy. And he told her that even at one time he considered kidnapping somebody. And he thought that that was a safe means of making money.
Okay.
So
I disagree, but yeah. Okay.
So by the end of October, that's when Kirst told Eisman that he was working on a plan to make them a lot of money. And then they would flee to Europe and they would live happily ever after.
Or Las Vegas.
And he was going to build a capsule to hold a kidnapped victim. She says she didn't help him with the design or the building of it. In fact, she said she never saw it until the night of the kidnapping. So in the meantime, Gary was searching for the perfect victim for the crime. Mm-hmm. And on November 8th, which was Ruth's birthday, surprise, I've got the perfect person in mind, he says.
Happy birthday, I found a victim.
But he never said the name. He wanted to research more. In his memoir, it's called Life, mm-hmm. The Man Who Kidnapped Barbara Mackle, was published in 1972. And this is, I'm reading this. Kirst claimed that he spent weeks in the Miami Public Library poring over social registers and newspaper clippings to find a target. He cut the list of 100 possible victims just down to 10, then eliminated those one by one until the single name of Barbara Jane Mackle was left.
If Mr. Smarty Pants would spend as much time trying to make money as he did researching to try to get money.
If he would, I mean, he was a smart man, but he wasn't smart enough to actually work for his money. He picked Barbara, he told Ruth, because she was strong and very smart. And since she was so intelligent, she could understand the instructions of the box better and therefore avoid being in danger. When Ruth went to trial, the jury didn't buy her excuse that she was blindly in love with Kirst and that she would have done anything for him. So she was convicted and sentenced to 7 years in prison. She was paroled after 4, and then she was promptly deported to her native Honduras. Now, she was from a wealthy family anyway. Her mom was a dentist, I believe. She went to Honduras, and she still is not allowed to enter the United States. But she was a perfect inmate. She loved art. She did a ton of art. And
macaroni art.
Macaroni art. So when she got out, her mother had died while she was in prison, and she inherited a bunch of property from her family. She also married a very wealthy man. So anyway, she had kids. She's now a grandmother, and she never talks about this ordeal either. So Kirst is a different story, all right? He loves attention. Before he went to trial, even, he went on a 30-day hunger strike. He claimed the guards were poisoning him, putting poison in his food, and he would only drink water. So he collapsed, and they strapped him down on a cot in the hospital and force-fed him and gave him glucose and IV. And then during his trial, he acted bored, and he read a book.
Oh, okay.
about microbiology.
Oh, sorry. Are we boring you?
Mm-hmm. So for the trial, he did try to seek the insanity plea. And when he would talk to the prison psychiatrist, he would say things like, I am a superior human being, and other kind of statements like that. The psychiatrist that evaluated Crist called him a borderline schizophrenic. So one thing that kind of tells you a little bit about Crist is he refused to acknowledge that the kidnapping plan was anything short of brilliant. And when people would talk to him about it and about all the details that would go wrong, he finally said, my only mistake was a minor miscalculation about the number of lawmen that was pursuing me on Hog Island. I mean, the psychiatrist wrote, he seems to have an obsession for others to think of him as a superior individual. He talked of his crime being part of a grand design which he had. The prosecution really saw it hard for the death penalty. And even Kirst knew it, and he told reporters that he expected to get the electric chair or whatever means these barbarian humans use these days.
It surprises me, since she didn't die, that they would see
that. Well, here's what happened. The jury convicted him, but a majority voted for execution, the death penalty. Mm-hmm. But four jurors held out for a life sentence. So they were forced to recommend mercy and give him life. Many people believe that the only reason he didn't get the death penalty is because when Barbara Meckel took the stand, she expressed an appreciation to Crist for sparing her life by phoning the FBI when he did, after the ransom. Yeah. The judge handed down the life sentence, and Crist did nothing. He stifled a yawn. But let me tell you about his jail time, Camille.
Please do.
In October of 69, Crist filed a petition complaining of the smallness of his cell and the loneliness of life under maximum security conditions.
Sucks.
And the food that was served at the prison.
At least you got food.
He said he was being cruelly, unusually, and subhumanly punished by solitary confinement. He objects to practically everything connected with imprisonment. His 9 feet by 5 feet cell is too cramped. And he complains that he rots in his concrete Georgia garbage can. There's no windows in his cell.
There was no windows in that coffin either, buddy.
And he said that he's a gregarious person, or so he characterizes himself. This is from the actual court case. And the only cellmates are his roaches, and he needs more company. His quarters contain only a bed, a table, a basin, a shelf, and a commode, and has supplied nothing but bon ami to cleanse the latter. So, yeah, he's a mess.
At least he had a bathroom.
He complained that the food is terrible and the diet is unbalanced. There's no fresh fruit or vegetables, and far too much of the nauseous herb called turnip greens. He doesn't get any exercise. He's restricted to 2 shower baths a week, suffers from a scalp disorder, and the right kind of shampoo is not available.
It's a travesty.
There's no television and no movies.
No movies? Draw the line right there.
He can't get books from the prison library without a lot of trouble. And he can't attend church services.
Well, he's in there private. He could just pray away by himself.
And the medical setup equally makes Crist angry. He complains that he did not get proper medication for his ear infection.
Not to mention that scalp condition.
And then he received too much medicine for a nerves condition in the form of tranquilizers.
He probably did that on purpose because they were listening to him gripe.
Yeah, so anyway, he filed this petition with the Superior Court and nothing came about.
Yeah, they laughed. They went out at Friday night happy hour and made fun of him.
Christmas of 1969, 1 year after it happened, both Ruth and Gary Crist sent Barbara Christmas cards.
Oh, they did it.
In the mail. Didn't put anything, just signed it. Crist also sent Barbara this long note apologizing and begging for forgiveness and all this kind of stuff. She never returned that either. July 71, Crist, they did a regular shakeup or shakedown, I guess, the prison guards. Mm-hmm. They found that he had loosened and partially sawed off the bars in his cell. They found a book on how to make masks.
Oh.
And 2 masks were made out of putty. They found those.
Maybe it was for Halloween.
Insect repellents and...
Again, Halloween night.
Toilet articles in a plastic bag, which I'm thinking toilet paper. And he'd also been making fake bars that was painted black to replace the real ones. He'd also been running 8 miles a day.
Oh, I thought he didn't get any exercise.
I know. Thank you. Hmm. And he was able to smuggle out this 700-page manuscript of his book that was later published in 1972.
I kind of like his
balls. God, I'd hate to be the editor of that book, but it was published in 72, and I think it was 380 pages long, so they really did. While in jail, Gary also told the jailers that he killed some people. Unsolved murders.
Oh, he did he?
According to Gary, his first victim was a 65-year-old hermit that he had had a homosexual relationship at the age of 14 while he was living in Pelican, Alaska.
If he was a hermit, how did anybody know he was gone?
I don't know. Chris said that he'd killed the man by tripping him while they were walking on a bridge across a deep ravine. Investigators verified the case and identical to what
it's
happened.
True?
Yeah. It had previously been described as death by accident.
Oh.
At 19, Gary said that he'd killed a girl near San Diego. He strangled and beat her to death and concealed her body under rocks.
And that was proven to be true, too?
Local officers confirmed the discovery of Helen Crow's body on October 3rd, 1964. Coroner's estimate of death occurred 6 to 8 weeks earlier. At the time, Christ was under lock and key at Tracy, California. His knowledge of the graphic details in this case remains a mystery. Hmm. My thought is he probably knew somebody who killed her, then she was in
locked
up.
Why is he confessing to all this?
Because he can. He's bragging. It's his thing.
Maybe he needs to carry pipes with him, too, if you know what I'm saying. He's got
something wrong with him. Third homicide he said he did was committed in 61, shortly after his escape from Utah.
I'm really surprised he didn't kill Barbara then. If he really did kill these people.
But according to Gary's confession, he picked up a homosexual described as a sissy and later killed his victim in a violent fit of rage. The body had been dumped near Wendover, Utah. There's local officers confirmed discovery of a skeleton on July 27th, 1967. The coroner's vague estimate of death some 3 to 5 years earlier roughly corresponds with Chris's period of freedom from custody. We know he didn't get very much of that. And then he also alluded to a fourth murder, but he never offered details. Since he was in prison, nothing to do. He couldn't take a shower but twice a week, and there's no movies. He began tutoring fellow inmates, and he taught them how to read and how to write, and he took college classes. He trained to be an EMT, and he worked at the prison hospital. He also cultivated a relationship. He was able to manipulate someone by the name of James T. Morris. Now, James...
See, that's it. He was always secretly gay, right? And, like, that's the problem.
He's a manipulator. He's a master manipulator. Okay. James T. Morris was influential and the chairman of the board of the Georgia Parole Board.
Oh, I thought it was another inmate. Ew. Ew.
So, back in those days, if somebody, even somebody that had a life sentence, they could still seek parole after 7 years.
Really?
And that's what he did.
Did he get paroled?
He and his prison pen pal, girlfriend, how do you like this name? Joan Jones.
Joan Jones.
Joan Jones.
I love Joan Jones.
Mm-hmm. They first tried parole at 7 years. They lined up all these doctors and professors that had worked closely with Christ, and they lobbied on his behalf to get paroled. Even Morris was trying to get him paroled, and it was all going well. And the thing that Christ promised to do was to go back to Alaska and work for his father on the fishing boat. Mm-hmm. Going perfectly until Alaska came back and said, yeah, we don't want him.
Yeah, don't blame him.
So that fell through. So a couple of years later in 79, Christ's father died. So Christ worked 3 extra years to work on James Morris. And at the hearing, James T. Morris said, because Barbara did not die, Christ deserves the parole that would get him north to Pelican, Alaska.
And south to my love.
In time to take over the family shrimp fishing business for the summer season. There is nothing in our files to indicate that Gary Stephen Christ is violent or dangerous.
Except for those 4 murders.
Murders, we don't know if he actually did that. If he does commit a crime, it won't be a crime of violence.
Break my heart, James T. Morris.
And Mrs. Woodward, she doesn't suffer from lasting trauma from her ordeal. There's nothing in our file that would indicate that there was any plan to kill, Mr. Morris said, noting that as soon as the ransom money was dropped off in Miami Park, Mr. Kirst called the FBI to tell them where the coffin was. In fact, the victim did live and is totally recovered. Therefore, the net result is little harm was done. The 10 years in prison has changed Mr. Kirst from a belligerent, self-styled con man to a man who just wants to go home and bail out the family business for his family.
And watch movies and take care of that.
And he was paroled. And the judge said, I don't think he's ever going to change. Given the nature of the case, burying a girl in the ground, I think it's a terrible mistake and I don't think he'll ever be rehabilitated. And the prosecutor at the trial said, he's going to be a menace to society for the rest of his life. Gary walked out of prison at age 33.
Did he really?
Mm-hmm. And waiting at the prison gates, Joan Jones.
Joan Jones.
And they got married because Carmen, his first wife, divorced him while he was in prison. So, Kirst is back in Alaska. He's on parole. And Kirst has this lifelong dream of being a doctor. So, he goes back to school to be a doctor. But the problem is, felons can't be a doctor.
Yeah.
So, what does he do? 10 years later, he calls up his buddy, James T. Morris. Morris started leaning on Gary's probation officer. And within 10 years of Gary walking out the prison doors, mm-hmm. he was pardoned.
What? How can you get pardoned from that? He obviously did it.
They pardoned him. I don't know why.
Pardon me, boy.
So he was pardoned, which allowed him to enroll
in medical school.
A second-rate Caribbean
medical school. I was thinking he should have been a mortician because, you know, he's already got the practice putting him in the ground.
He gets his license to be a doctor, or he goes to school in the Caribbean to get his medical degree. He went to Ross University School of Medicine. Yes. And part of his schoolwork, he trained in Connecticut Hospital and he didn't give his criminal history. But after somebody he worked with recognized him, he left the hospital. So he graduated from Ross, and he did a 4-year residency in a psychiatric hospital.
How convenient.
It didn't last 4 years because, you know, he racked up a bunch of disciplinary files for misconduct with patients. Oh. Rude comments, sexual contact. Like, he told a 13-year-old girl with an eating disorder, boy, you have a big butt. He told a patient that tested positive for HIV, said, boy, your boyfriend must be thrilled.
It's terrible.
I know. He questioned a patient. He badgered her, basically, about her sex life when she came in for a dermatology problem. He made another one uncomfortable when he was doing a breast exam and mentioned her big boobs. And when a woman came in for a sore throat, he gave her a back rub and a massage. This man, he's not right. He denied it all. He denied touching her. And so it gets worse from there. After all this, he abandoned his residency there. So,
gee, why? It's going so well.
But it says here in the article, he said, but he's no quitter. In 98, he was applying for a medical license in Alabama, said no. But Indiana
said yes.
Considered and decided to give Kirst another chance, and they granted him a license with the probationary restrictions.
Was it in dermatology, gynecology?
Well, he's good at that. They never said what he was arrested for.
Oh,
yeah.
Arrested?
Or what they never, during his probationary period, they were supposed to list what his grievances or what his felony charge was or why he was pardoned. They never mentioned what it was. So anyway, just to make a long story short, in October of 2003, believe it or not, his medical license was revoked. So he's not a doctor anymore.
Wow.
But that's not the end of the story. Gary married Joan Jones, and Joan Jones had a son. And in 2001, while Gary was telling little eating disorder girls they had big butts. And
he could not lie.
He and his stepson started a construction company.
He's got a lot. He's got his hands in a lot of stuff.
He does. And they called it Greason and Crist Construction Incorporated. Mm. The company claimed it specialized in sheet metal fabrication and bulletproof rooms. Mm. Mm-hmm. So after Gary's license was revoked, he moved back to Georgia and began working for this construction company. But he still wanted to get rich quick, right? So Gary rented a 27-foot sailboat in Alabama. Mm-hmm. Just before Christmas of 2004. He gets like this bipolar thing at Christmas time. Thinking that's what it is. So federal authorities believed he sailed to Colombia and he bought a kilo of cocaine. Mm-hmm. A year later, Kirsten Greason, they chartered a boat in the Mobile Bay Marina from November 14th to December 4th, 2005. Mm-hmm. The men sailed to South America and bought 6 kilos of cocaine, which is about 13 pounds. When they returned from the trip, the charter company found a map of the Colombian coast. So the boat charter firm contacted the authorities. When Gary reserved another sailboat a month later, in January, federal agents installed a tracking bug on the vessel.
This guy has had, he's like led so many different lives, right? Mm-hmm. I've done nothing like
He's like 70 now. And again, they went to Colombia. And when they returned to Mobile Bay on March 6th, an army of local state and federal lawmen rushed the boat as it docked. They seized 4 illegal aliens, 2 from Colombia, 2 from Ecuador. They had each paid Kirst $6,000 apiece to bring them back to the United States. And a cooler they found that contained 38 pounds of cocaine paste, which street value was estimated to be about $2 million.
He's finally getting rich, but he's going to get caught.
Well, he got caught. So the authorities believe that he used the profits from his earlier sales to go back and buy more, which progressively larger amounts of cocaine.
See, that's where he failed, because if he would have just stopped, he would have had a little money there, you know, but greedy.
He's greedy. One of the agents that did this bust said that Gary had rigged a really clever quick release for the cocaine that was in the cooler, just in case the boat was boarded by
agents.
Basically, the cooler was filled with cement and it was held in place with a rope. And so if it came, it would just take a second to cut the rope and it would sink quickly. And then they would have never have known that the cocaine was there. Yeah. I don't know.
Probably not. Deep, yeah. Right?
They said that if the evidence would have sunk, they would have never found it. The agent said that it was a very good setup by a very smart man. And you know Gary loved that. So in March, a couple days after this, the drug investigators went to search Gary's home. And there they discovered a concealed trap door in the floor of a garden shed. When they opened it, there was a ladder that when they climbed down, there was a submarine-style workshop that was pretty much a metal cylinder measuring 27 and a half feet.
And that's what he should have buried Barbara in. That would have been much nicer.
By 8 feet in diameter. Down there was a laboratory that had running water, electricity. It was stocked with chemicals, containers used to convert the cocaine from paste to powder, which authorities believe Crist and Greason then sold in Atlanta. The lab also featured an escape route, which was a tunnel about 20 feet long that slowly worked its way up to the surface. And when it ended, the top was a 50-gallon barrel, which you would pop out of this 50-gallon barrel and you could escape. So he was charged. He helped get another drug lord down, so he only got 5 years, 5 months in prison. And he's still alive. He's in Atlanta, I believe, where Barbara's in Atlanta. And that's the story. That's a long-ass story, and I apologize, but all the stuff for Gary was too much not to leave out.
It's a Johnny Depp movie.
He's crazy. He's insane. Very smart man, if he just would have worked.
Would have put his powers to good and not evil.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, that's that.
Well, that was something, let me tell you.
That was long. Sorry.
Yeah, but he I mean, just think the life he led. My gosh.
Unreal.
Unbelievable.
Unreal. And just to think what other stuff he got into. And it said that some people loved him. Some people hated him. That there was like no middle.
If he would have just been a little bit more careful, he probably would have been successful.
He always got caught. He had the shittiest luck, but he kept doing it. And another thing that was interesting that I didn't include is while they were digging the grave, while Ruth, Gary were digging the grave, they stopped by the town's drugstore or little market. And the guy that ran the market at the time said they bought 3 sodas, 3 honey buns, and 3 of something else. And he's like, you cannot tell me that there's only 2 people there. I swear to God, there was a 3rd person helping them.
Oh, really?
And then, yeah, in the confession, I read it quickly. Ruth mentions that Jake dug the hole too deep. So I don't know whatever came out of that.
Interesting. All right. You can find us on Facebook. We have a discussion page, our True Crime Podcast discussion page. You can catch us on Twitter at Our True Crime Pod. You can listen to us anywhere you listen to your favorite podcast.
Anywhere.
Anywhere. Podcatcher, Podbean, Stitcher,
Spotify, iTunes, Spotify,
YouTube.
You can go to PodCoin. I think you get paid for being on PodCoin, for downloading stuff on PodCoin.
You can email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com.
Yep.
And I believe that's it.
I think that's it too.
That was interesting. That needs to be a movie. I'm telling
you. It's unreal. So many people in and out of it, it would be good.
Like a good Scorsese film or something, you know?
Your butt's too big.
All right, Jen. All right. So remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows. Love you. So around Christmas time.
Hi, cutie. What are you
smile
doing?
Smile
for. I know. Your tea looks so pretty. Those are cute little slippers. Where'd you get those?
Run. Call Reggie and run in those.
Reggie! What is he paying?
He bites him as she walks. God, yeah.
She's so stinking cute.
So it was... Okay.
Sorry.
And during finals... Brenda came down with the flu. Now, it just wasn't...
Is it Brenda?
No, it was Barbara. So I'm going to go...
Remember when I had them really sick in second grade and almost died?
Mm-hmm. My mom told me, and I'm like, oh, that's sad.
Oh, that's sad. Thanks, Jen.
That's okay. I was sad.
No, you weren't. You were sad and then said, okay, I'm going to go outside and play now.
I was playing with Barbies inside, but whatever. Okay. So, police went back to the scene. And they found an abandoned white boat and a blue Volvo station wagon that was abandoned. Did I say that already?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was abandoned.
Were they abandoned?
They were abandoned. Oh. Nobody was there. It was abandoned.
Was anybody there? Was it abandoned?
I think it was abandoned.
Okay.
There's nobody there. Or they think it was abandoned.
Oh. Did they? What did they think?
They think that it was, they thought it was abandoned.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So.
Well, I'm glad it was abandoned.
Yeah. They ran the boat's registration number. And in the Volvo, it's Volvo.
I know
in my Volvo. You'd not believe what people found in my Volvo.
You drive a car in that thing.
You could. A truck. Damn. All right. It was an abandoned home site overgrown with.
Overgrown. It got weeds sprouting up everywhere.
Out here in Georgia.
Can I read this to you real quick?
Yeah.
So I'm looking at the invasion, or evading the dogs. Common tracking dogs include bloodhounds and German shepherds, whether it's law enforcement canine unit or the military unit going after enemies of the state. I'd like to say that if you're a crook or considering a crime, there are several ways that criminals are caught, even well-thought-out criminals, including the white-collar types, and often it can happen weeks or even months after the crime has taken place. Here's the golden thing. Instead of committing a crime to try to better your circumstances, clean up your act and clean up your thinking. For a lot of people, that means finding faith. Jesus is in the business of changing lives. With that said, let's talk about escaping tracking dogs.
Jesus can save you, but if not, here's how we can get away from dogs. Yeah.
That made me laugh. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Love will find a way. Do you know?